Good morning, it's Shauna Nyquist, and I am so excited about this episode of the podcast. This is our fourth episode, and I can't wait to introduce you to my friend, Ian Cron. He is a great writer. His first book, Chasing Francis, is just a beautiful story. He is a beautiful writer. His second book, Jesus, My Father, the CIA, and Me, is a fascinating memoir. I totally recommend it. And then his most recent book is called The Road Back to You, and it's all about the Enneagram and using it as a path for healing and growth. And if you know me at all, you know that I am a giant Enneagram fan, and I'm always looking for ways to introduce people to it. So what better way to do that than have Ian talk with us about it a little bit? He's been a friend of mine and Aaron's for a long time. We love him and his family and his kids, and they've been guests in our home, and they're people who teach us a lot about life with Christ, about literature, about family, about the Enneagram, all of the above. Ian's a wise person that I admire and I'm thankful for in my life. So I'm so excited that you're gonna get to learn a little bit about him and about the Enneagram. So our sponsor for this week is a company that I love. You know that I am a bookworm and that a great book is one of the greatest pleasures in my life. And I also love to listen to books. I love to listen to books when I drive or when I'm on a bike ride or something like that. And so Audible is our sponsor this week. If you have not listened to a book on Audible before, I totally recommend it. They make it really easy. We are about to go into summertime, and if you were looking for a great series, I'm just gonna shamelessly plug a series that I love. If you have not read the Louise Penny Inspector Gamache series, I think they are the most charming. And if you listen to them on Audible, you get to listen to it read by the author, and that's my favorite. I love when you get to hear the author's voice, a little bit of their accent and tone. So Louise Penny reads all of the Inspector Gamache series, and I'm such a fan. So if I were you, I would go get a free 30-day trial. All you have to do is sign up at audible.com/Shauna Nyquist, and I would go ahead and download those Louise Penny books for my summer if I were you. So audible.com/Shauna Nyquist will get you a free 30-day trial. Good morning. I am so happy to introduce you all. Many of you know him, I'm sure, but my friend Ian Cron. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning, Shauna. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to hear your voice.
And yours too.
So I was thinking about the first time we met, and correct me if I'm wrong, we met because you were a friend of my husband's first, and we went out for coffee in Nashville. And I had a little baby with me, and that little baby's about to be 6 years old.
Oh, yes, I do remember that now.
Yes, so that was 6 years ago, almost. And since then, you have been in our home, and you and your kids have been in our home, and you have written, I think, at least two great books since then. And the one that I'm really excited to talk about today is your most recent book. Can you just give everybody just like a quick, what is that book about?
Yeah, so it's called The Road Back to You. The subtitle is An Enneagram Journey to Self-Discovery. And it's about this wonderful, quirky, odd, but uncannily accurate personality typology called the Enneagram. That a lot of people seem to know a little bit about.
So that's, you know, you and I have several things in common. We love books, we love language, but we both love the Enneagram. And I feel like when we first started talking about it, it was a little less present in kind of the greater conversation. How did you initially get introduced to the Enneagram?
Yeah, so I was in seminary. It was in the 1990s, and I was at a Catholic retreat center, and I happened on a copy of Richard Rohr's book, The Enneagram, A Christian Perspective. But it was the very first edition, so it was like this kooky blue cover, and you know, it was the one before the one that's out now, the newer edition. And I was in a counseling program at the time, getting my master's in counseling. And I remember thinking to myself, where has this been? Like, this is crazy useful. And they weren't teaching it at the seminary where I was attending, and I couldn't understand why. And And, you know, it has sort of haunted me since. And in recent years, I just dove really deep into the system and learned it and thought, man, I got to share this with more people.
And now, so I'm going to skip ahead and give one of the punchlines. Tell us your type.
Oh, so I'm a four.
Right.
The romantic or the tragic artist sometimes, as they're known, or the individualist. And we're people who are motivated by a deep need to be special and unique. And of the nine types, we're the sort of the least represented in the population. We're kind of those melancholy, if we were stereotyping, I'd say, those kind of clove cigarette smoking, Baudelaire reading, you know, artists wandering around on the beach, you know, thinking about somewhat depressing topics to other people.
Yes, I'm familiar with all this because I am married to a four.
Yes,
and,
you
and,
are.
And all of those words that you just said, I'm like, uh-huh. Yep. So, but you said something, statistically speaking, there are fewer fours represented in population. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's you know, it's all speculation, you know, but they appear to be the least represented of all the types in the broader population. And sixes, the loyalists or the devil's advocates, as they're sometimes called, they are the most prevalent in the population.
Oh, that there's a lot to unpack there. And one thing that I've read as well is that different parts of the country and different countries will have different representations, that there are certain countries that have more of one type or another. Have you found that to be true?
Yeah, I think, or they have sort of the characteristic traits, you know, as a culture. You know, they have so ones are known as the perfectionists or the reformers. And definitely you go to Switzerland and you think to yourself, yeah, that's a pretty one country right there. It's, you know, impeccably organized and run so, you know, every train's on time. Everything's just corner squared and perfect, you know.
That sounds a lot like me. I'm just kidding.
Yeah,
I'm totally kidding.
Yeah,
there's nothing about me that's
you.
Like that.
Mm-mm. No, I wonder what sevens are. You're a seven. The enthusiasts, I wonder who the enthusiasts would be.
From what I've read, they say that the sevens are primarily in Brazil and and Ireland.
I was going to say Ireland.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. They're just a, you know, wonderful, carefree, spontaneous, fun adventures. Now, the Irish do have a four side.
Yes.
For sure, they have a four side. But boy, when they're in that zone of the next great thing, they are a blast.
So let's take one step back. And if someone is like, hold the phone, you've now been talking about numbers that I don't understand for five solid minutes. Take a step back, and if you were having a preliminary conversation, what is the Enneagram? Why is it valuable? And then if you could put just a couple words or sentences around each type.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, just that. Ooh. Could you just run through
okay.
that?
Okay. Yeah. So you'll laugh at this. I just spoke at the Q conference.
Yeah.
And they gave me 9 minutes to talk about, I was assigned the topic. Gabe Lyons assigned me the topic. It was on a kind of like, why it's important to understand your dark side, something like that, something along those lines. I had 9 minutes to do this, and it took me 20 hours to write 9 minutes.
I feel like that's like one of those, like, all of Shakespeare in 45 minutes or something, right?
It's exactly what it's like. It's exactly what it's like. It was a nightmare. Okay, so the Enneagram, ancient personality typology, it suggests that there are nine basic core personality types in the world, one of which we all gravitate or adopt one in childhood. You know, one of those we're going to gravitate toward and adopt in childhood. Each of them has an underlying motivation that operates sort of in the operating system of our lives that drives these traits and behaviors that we exhibit on a day-to-day basis regularly. So, the ones are called the perfectionists. I just mentioned them. They're motivated by a need to be perfect to perfect the world around them and other people. They are wonderful human beings when they're in a healthy, good space. They're like Atticus Finch or Gandhi. You know, they're great reformers. when they're not in such a great space, they can kind of deteriorate into a very judgmental, kind of a critical, resentful presence in the world that, you know, is kind of put off by the idea that no one else can live up to their high internal standards. Twos are called the helpers. They are motivated by a need to be needed by others, to meet the needs of others. These folks are the most loving, engulfing, mothering presences in the world. They are always the ones in the kitchen cleaning up at the, you know, when everyone else has gone home, helping you in the kitchen, you know. When they're healthy, fantastic. They, you know, who doesn't love someone who's a helper? But when they're unhealthy, they are operating with this sort of mindset that they know what you need more than you know what you need, and they're determined to meet those needs whether you want them to or not. They can be a little flattering, and they can be manipulative, kind of calculated givers, because they're looking for you to give in return without their having to ask for your help. That's what they want. Threes are called the performers, the achievers. These are the sort of the quintessential American type. These are people who have a need to succeed and avoid failure at all costs. When they're healthy, they're really looking out for helping other people succeed. When they're unhealthy, they tend to be self-promotional, self-marketing, people that will do anything at any cost to win. Fours are called the individualists. We just spoke about them. Aaron and I share this wonderful Jesus-like space. Fours are motivated by a need to be special or unique. These are folks who feel like they're missing something important inside, something essential in their makeup for which they have to compensate by being unique and special and bringing – these are people who just see meaning and metaphor and richness in all of life. And there's a disproportionate number of them in the creative world among artists. But we can, you know, kind of go to this quirky place of melancholy and doing things that actually thwart our finding the belongingness in the world that we really want to have. Fives are called the investigators. Fives are motivated by a need to understand, to perceive, to just figure out how things work. These are aggregators of tremendous amounts of information and knowledge, and they gather knowledge, particularly around niche subjects, because they believe that if they can just know enough, that they'll never appear inept, inadequate to the tasks of life. So they look to knowledge for the things that other people look to love and the love and support of others to. You know, they knowledge becomes the king of all currencies for them. Sixes are the loyalists. These are people who have a need to feel secure and safe in the world. These are worst case scenario thinkers. These are people who are always scanning the horizon. They're looking for what could go wrong next. They are marvelously funny people when they're healthy, because they leverage all that anxiety and turn it into something really funny. Like, think about someone like Larry David, for example, I think is someone who presents like a six. When they're healthy, they are loyal, community-minded. They really hold groups of people together. When they're unhealthy, they tend to make decisions based on fear, and that never ends well for anybody. Sevens, oh, those sevens, next to fours, finest number in the world. Enthusiasts, these are people who have a need to avoid psychological and emotional pain or unpleasant feelings. And the way they do it is by looking outside of themselves into the future toward the next great adventure or escapade or fascinating idea or new book or new meal or new whatever. It's just always into the future, avoiding the present moment where they may encounter unpleasant, afflictive emotions. Eights are called the challengers. These are blunt, domineering, aggressive, confrontational forces of nature. These are people who have a need to be in control, to be strong, to control the environment, and all in service to hiding those more tender, softer, vulnerable interior feelings and that space in their life that is more innocent, if you will. they are unmistakable when you see them. When they're healthy, they're like Martin Luther King. When they're unhealthy, they're like Vladimir Putin, you know. And then finally, the nines. I'm married to a nine. I have a daughter who's a nine. Magnificent people. They're the peacemakers. They're really motivated by a need to avoid conflict at all costs. Nines are remarkable human beings when they're healthy. We've had, I think, probably three of our last five presidents have been nines. When they're unhealthy, though, they are willing to do whatever it takes to maintain that sense of inner calm and peace in the world around them, the status quo. And that means sometimes sublimating or putting off to the side their own, asserting their own preferences, opinions, and desires so that it doesn't, so they don't arouse conflict with other people. They just kind of merge and blend in with people. And in service to, I don't want to, you know, rock the boat. I want to keep things going nice and easy. So that's a very, you know, 50,000 foot, 600 million miles an hour flyby of what are otherwise very nuanced and, you know, deeper understandings of those types.
That was spectacular. I think you set a speed record. And what's interesting is I've done a fair amount of work on Enneagram stuff, and I've heard you talk about before. Obviously, I've read your book. There were a couple things that I heard you say just then that I've never heard about the Enneagram that was really interesting to me. So thank you for doing that. Mm-hmm. A couple things. So I've never heard, or maybe only from you, that sixes are known for being funny. I've never heard that.
Oh, yeah.
That's interesting to me, and it makes sense to me. It's sort of that, like, laugh or cry, the anxiety that fuels a sense of humor. That connects with me.
Oh, my gosh. Think about, like, Woody Allen.
Totally. Have
you ever seen this old Woody Allen, Carl Reiner, who's that? George Costanza.
Totally.
You know, oh, my gosh. You know, it's like they take all that anxiety, and they just put a spotlight on it, and it makes you laugh because you're like, yeah, I've been anxious about that before. Not quite that anxious, but that's funny because, you know.
I love
being afraid
that.
And anxious can be hysterical.
The other thing that you a little piece that you put together for me just now is that a five uses knowledge or information in a place where other people would use emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never heard it stated that way, but one of my dear friends is going through a loss of a relationship and is a five and is haunted by not understanding the other person's perspective. So it's less about a hurt feeling and more about if I could understand the perspective.
Yes.
And that's helping me understand her right now as we've been talking about this. Wow.
Yes, totally. Everything gets intellectualized. If I can master it at the level of my rational mind.
Yeah. If I can
I feel secure and safe.
Yeah. If I can put together all the pieces. And then you mentioned sort of in passing that you think maybe three of our more recent presidents are nines. Which ones?
Mm-hmm. I think Bill Clinton was a nine.
Really?
Yeah, most people say, oh, he's clearly a three. And I say, no, listen. Guys don't make peace deals in Bosnia and Northern Ireland unless they know how to reconcile irreconcilable differences the way that nines do. People that I know who worked with him said that his magic in the White House, his charisma was not based on like the Slick Willie accusation, you know. It was really more that he had so much empathy and the ability to see things through everybody else's eyes, which nines are just, they can see perspectives from every angle, that everybody felt like he understood them and they just were the empathy. When he said, I get you, I understand your pain, you know, I get your pain, you know, I feel your pain, he really did. And people were just hooked right into it. I think Gerald Ford was a nine. I think arguably that George W. Bush was a nine.
Really?
Yeah. I think, but that's a long.
I had thought.
That's a long sort of conversation though.
I had thought he was a six.
Some people will say he's a six, but I think that where the nine comes out in him a little bit is, he was suggestible.
Okay.
I think he was suggestible to other people's influences.
Sure. And then Obama, would you say as a nine?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. it's too difficult to say because the environment there is so is such that it's just hard to know what anybody is based on what you see. I think he aspired to be and have nine qualities.
I think that's an interesting, I think if you take a step back and look at something like the presidency, one would assume certain character traits would be, you know, like maybe you'd have this really aggressive eight or this really achievement oriented three. But to say in actuality, maybe what makes a person more successful or capable in that role is that empathy and bridge building and seeing through someone else's eyes. I think that's a little bit of a shift from what we usually think about in that role.
Oh, listen, if you have a nine, they're deal makers. I mean, that was Bill Clinton's genius. This guy was a deal maker. So to have someone who's easygoing and listens and says, yeah, I see your point of view, but what if we do this? And, you know, apes are, they're more of, you know, they're more like steamrollers than diplomats, you know. Threes, you know, people won't necessarily feel like they're being heard and understood as much sometimes by a three as they would by a nine. A nine is genuinely able to see everybody's perspective and find a way to the middle ground.
I love that. Okay, so if let's say someone is just listening to this, and you know, I would imagine that if someone listens to just even that like little snippet of each of the nine types, they can say, well, you might not be entirely certain about what one type you are, but you can at least cross a couple off. Mm-hmm. What would you recommend are the next two or three steps? Someone says, like, I want to know more about this. Obviously, your book is a great starting point. What other things? Is it a set of conversations? Do you recommend the quiz? What are the next steps that you would send someone? What's the path you would send them down?
Okay. So when it comes to like assessments, right, whether it's like the one that you can find around my stuff or anywhere, I always put a disclaimer on mine that says, all self-report assessments, doesn't matter if it's Myers-Briggs or Enneagram stuff or Colby or StrengthsFinder, doesn't matter. They are plagued with a high margin of error because they, you know, they have to assume, the test assumes that the person is self-aware enough to answer the questions accurately about their own type.
Right.
And of course, that, you know, that's a recipe for inaccuracy. So the best way to learn about the Enneagram is by reading and going to workshops and listening to other people describe themselves and their own journey within their type, and you will just begin to pick it up. It's just the best way to do it. It's the most accurate way.
I totally agree with you. At this point, I tell people not to take an assessment. I have a friend who I was doing a workshop with, and it was about for 75 college students, and she wanted to do the quiz. And I said, let me just run like a crazy experiment. Let's do it both ways. Let's do it without the quiz for some kids, and then let's do it with just like a self-assessment through listening to other people tell their stories. And we found throughout that process that the quiz was only 50% accurate. Mm-hmm. And I think, I'm sure you find this. So when I do it, if you're at a small Christian college, a little bit more traditional, everybody aspires to be a two, right? Yep. Because they're the nicest, right? If you're doing it in a leadership oriented business environment, everybody just magically happens to be, let's say, a three, you know? Right. It's more aspirational maybe than it is an accurate self-assessment sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I think it also falls on gender lines. I think, certainly in a more traditional environment, women feel pressed to be twos. Men maybe feel pressed to be eights, whether or not those things are accurate. There's a little bit of, if I could only be that, I would be living up to some perceived stereotypical role.
Yep.
Once someone knows their type, then what? What is the good that can come? And obviously you're preaching to the choir. I'm a fan, but what is the good that can come from understanding your type and the types of the people around you?
Yeah. Well, once you know kind of the way that you are in the world, I mean, you to be lacking in self-awareness and self-knowledge is a tremendous handicap. You know, when you don't understand what's operating underneath the waterline of your life, you know, you are at the mercy of that which is unconscious, that which you can't see, right? So once you know and develop some some self-knowledge about your way of being in the world, you first of all develop the ability to make new and better choices. You're not running on autopilot. You're not on auto self. You're able to see, okay, this is how people of my type typically respond in this sort of a situation. In the past, before I knew as much as I do know about myself now, this is how I would automatically respond, yeah, in a state of reactivity. But now that I know that that doesn't work, doesn't end well, typically, I can, you know, choose other paths that will be better for me and for everybody concerned. And ultimately, I just think it gives you such compassion for other people and for yourself, and just wisdom about how to interact with the world around you. So I can just go on with lists of things that the benefits of understanding the Enneagram, but yeah, those are a couple that I think are helpful.
I totally agree. And I would say, and you've heard me say this before, it's been one of the most helpful tools in my marriage. Because Aaron and I, fours and sevens, I think they complement each other well, but they're not very similar. So like,
oh my gosh.
Right? Is that an understatement?
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So the,
you bet.
Yeah. So the things often that are healthy for me, the path toward health for me looks really different. Mm-hmm. Or the path toward, and so I think it helps us, yes, be compassionate with one another, but it also helps us, I think, respect our differences and pursue what's healthy for each of us, even if that looks a little bit different.
Yes, you bet. You know, I'll give you an example of this. So I have a friend of mine who's a five, who's married to a seven. And before they understood the Enneagram, there was always, you know, sort of like the, you know how it is in a marriage, you, for years, if you don't really understand each other, you continually have the same frictions, you know, like same arguments. So it's like a script that's running, you know?
Yeah, I've heard of this from other people.
Yes, from other people. So when you have a five and a seven, like they would go to a party and he would want to go home at 8 and she would want to go home at 3:30 in the morning.
Yes.
You know, like still, you know, because he had a limited amount of energy for these kind of, for interactions, and she had an unlimited amount of energy for it. So now they take two cars.
Totally.
They know the Enneagram. They're like, you know what? I know that you can't. It's actually not in your capacity to stay all night. We'll take two cars. And if we choose to go home at the same time, great. If we don't, that's fine too.
So
it makes for accommodations. But also, one of the things I say about the Enneagram is that makes it particularly useful as a spiritual tool. Is it not only points out like your strengths and what's best about you, it's also going to show you that what's best about you is also what's worst about you. That which is your blessing is also your curse. And it reveals places where you really need to grow up and evolve as a human being.
I would say that's, and for me, that was one of the big aha moments. I think I saw, you know, there were a couple positive traits in my life that I was thankful to have, that I wanted to cultivate. And then there was this whole mess of things that I just hated about myself. And once I saw them as related to one another, and that kind mm-hmm. of you can't have those kind of beautiful, bright parts without those challenging, dark parts, it helped me see myself, I think, more as a whole integrated person, as opposed to if only I could close down that back dirty part and it could go away. Life is about managing all of those things and doing the best we can with that whole assorted pile.
Yeah, I agree.
So in just a second, I want to switch over to another part of our conversation, but just last thing. So it's The Road Back to You. And is there a website? Is it your website? Is it The Road Back to You website? Where would you send people for more information?
Yeah, they could sure go to iankron.com. They could also go to theroadbacktoyou.com and learn all about the book and about speaking things and podcasts and, you know, all the stuff that we have happening. And I'm heading into a new book project, which is oddly enough on the topic we're talking about, which is, okay, so now that I know my Enneagram number, that's all fine and good, but now what do I do? What do I do once I have this information? How do I leverage self-knowledge into something that operationally on an everyday basis is making me someone who doesn't just have a good personality, but somebody who is becoming a good person.
I am a huge fan of the Enneagram. It's been a really transformational tool for me, for my marriage, in my family. And Ian talks about it in a way that I think is so clear and so grounded and so interesting. If you're going to start one place, if you're going to get one Enneagram book and start there, this is the one I would recommend. So it's called The Road Back to You. And I think it would be a great family conversation if you're going away together this summer and want to have kind of a starting place to talk about how God made each of you, or a friend group or a small group. For me, it's been a wonderful tool. Another one of our sponsors today is a really cool company called Cladwell. If you're anything like me, you have that feeling sometimes of like packed drawers and closets and absolutely nothing to wear. One of the things that I've been really focusing on the last couple years is paring down. I love that capsule idea. I love figuring out exactly what it is that works for me and getting rid of the rest of it and making things really easy. And that's exactly what Cladwell does. They sort of come alongside of you and help you manage what you already have to find the things you already have that you love that can make your life more simple. So I really love what they're doing. I think it's a cool company with a great mission. I'm totally on board with this idea of simplifying, making it easier to get out the door in the morning, making your stuff something you don't have to think about a ton, just making it a little bit more manageable so that you can love what you actually have. So this great company is called Cladwell. And I would love for you to check out what they're doing. They have a lot of great blog articles, all of that stuff. It's at cladwell.com/Shauna. In a minute, I want to talk about something we both love, which is books. And then meals. First, I want to ask something I ask every guest. What is one spiritual practice of any kind that's helping you or healing you in this season?
Man, it's been the same one for a long time. I have a daily meditation set.
And what does that look like?
Well, on a good day, at 20 to 25 minutes on a cushion in centering prayer, I guess some people would call it. Some people outside, let's say, in the world at large might call it mindfulness meditation. For me, I spend 20 to 25 minutes on my rear end, just clearing my mind, centering my life, and coming back home to myself in a way, in the world of distraction and nuttiness that we live in. So that is a steady practice for me, without which I would be a mess.
I love that. Do you do that at the same time every day?
Generally, I do it in the morning, first thing, you know, coffee and the cushion. That's where I go.
Awesome.
It actually, I have to tell you, is like of all the spiritual practices I've ever had over the years, it's the one that has the most clear, perceptive, palpable results that I can point to and say, that's been it. That's been the place where I've changed and grown the most.
So it would be something at this point in your life that you would notice the absence.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And everybody else would too.
Right. People are like, where's that cushion again?
You don't have to get on the cushion, pal.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Thank you. Okay, let's talk about books. You and I are sort of book twins in that we like a lot of the same books. We're passionate about writers and about books. So I'm really looking forward to this part of the conversation. Ian, what is your all-time favorite book?
Oh.
I know. It's so hard. It's ridiculous.
Oh,
I know.
Oh, my gosh. Now you're throwing a four into a major crisis, because no matter what I say to you, I'm going to get off the phone and regret it. I'm going to be texting you the rest of the day with other book titles. Well,
good.
You know, during this season of my life, this clearly was the best book. Oh, I take that back. This is the best book.
I know. It's like, what's your favorite child? I mean, it's a totally impossible question.
Yeah. But I do have a favorite child.
Okay.
Oh. But I won't. It's up to them to figure it out.
I know which one it is.
My favorite beloved Toni Morrison, probably.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's a must read for everyone.
I remember I started reading that on a Sunday night, and I didn't go back to work until Tuesday afternoon.
Oh, I love reading like that. I think the last time I did that, do you remember when Lauren Winter's book Still came out? I had a new baby. All I should have been doing was going straight to bed. And I sat in the hallway outside the nursery all night long until I finished that book. And I think there is, there are very few greater pleasures than that kind of reading experience.
Well, I could give you about 10 other of my favorite books of all time if you want. But we'll stick with that one for the sake of time.
So what was your favorite book as a child?
Oh, I was a weird little kid.
I can see that, if that's an okay thing to say.
Okay, so I'll give you the answer that you know, is the one that people go, oh yeah, I get it, and then I'll give them the head scratcher. My Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh yeah, totally.
Absolutely loved it. I remember where I was when I read it. I just, I was swept away by that book. I loved it so much. And then maybe P.G. Woodhouse's Scoop.
Wow.
I loved, as a little kid, we had lived in England, and so I had that mind that my family had recently moved back from England, and I just had that English-British humor bug that I loved.
I
loved P.G. Woodhouse, all of his books.
Well, as long as we're talking about your childhood, can we talk about my deep admiration for your mother?
Oh, yes, you can.
The woman I aspire to be. Will you tell our listeners just a little bit about your fantastic, interesting mother?
Oh, my mother is the best. So my mom she's going to be 89 in about another, I don't know, 5 days. She, as I like to tell, my mom is a redheaded force. She's just a force of nature. For the last 74 of her 89 years, she has smoked Pall Malls every day. She eats bacon with impunity. She doesn't exercise. She doesn't wear glasses. She doesn't need hearing aids. She is just a ball of intensity in life. I mean, she calls me on the phone and she'll say things like, "Are you still writing that book about the angiogram?" You know, that kind of stuff. And she just makes me laugh. She's just a remarkable human being.
Every once in a while, Ian will text me a picture of his mother, and she'll be like, you know, she has this gorgeous red hair, and she'll be like standing in front of a mural in Brooklyn wearing like yellow high heels and like floral, really cute pants, smoking a cigarette. And I'm like, I really want this to be my future. Like I understand this woman in like a deep, fundamental way. She is my people.
Oh, she is your people. And I would not actually like to get the two of you into the same city, no less the same room. Bad things would happen. It would be something to see.
Delightful, outrageous things would happen.
You know the word I use to describe her now? I say that she's tornadic.
Oh,
isn't that a great word?
I love that. Yes.
She is tornadic. She just comes in like she's fantastic. Yeah.
Okay. So what are two or three of the best books you've read just this year? Just a couple favorites recently.
Wow. So there's a book I'm reading right now that I really like by a guy at Notre Dame. His name is Thomas Halleck, and it's called "I Want You to Be on the God of Love." And it's a beautifully written book, just a lovely read, but intellectually rigorous too at the same time. It's not a simple read, but it's well worth it. I'm reading a collection. A friend of mine just gave me a collection of Philip Levine's poems that just came out this year called "What Work Is." I'm a poetry guy. I love good poetry.
Yep.
Not a lot of people read poetry, but I consider a poetry book a book. And so I've been reading through those poems in the morning. I try to read a poem every morning as a discipline. That's another one of my little kooky disciplines.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, one poem a morning. Have you ever – actually, there's some the Poetry Foundation and the Writer's Almanac. If you subscribe, you'll get a poem every morning in your email.
Oh, I love that. I go through phases with poetry, but I'm always better when I'm reading more poetry. Absolutely.
Do you know why it's good for a 7?
Why?
Because you can't read poetry fast.
Totally. Yeah, anything that slows down any part of me is always a healthy move.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I'd say Philip Levine – his poems have been kind of big. And I've been reading so many darn Enneagram books and psychology books. So I'm afraid like some of mine are kind of boring books, you know, about psychology. You know, one is a wonderful book, but it's got a goofy title. James Hollis's book, Finding Meaning in the Second Half of Life.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Is a really well-written, smart book by a Jungian. that's, you know, accessible at the same time. And he writes like a poet, which makes it really great.
Oh, I'm writing that down. That sounds great.
Oh, you will love that book.
Okay. Is there a book that you reread?
I'll reread Franny and Zoe by Salinger.
Mm-hmm.
I reread Max Picard's book, The World of Silence.
Oh, interesting. I'm writing that one down as well.
Yeah, that's a beautiful book. It's by a philosopher, a French philosopher, who also happened to be a poetic writer. So it's not like that, you know, and it's about silence. I mean, that's, you know, about the beauty of silence. And it's a book that I go back to repeatedly.
I love that.
I go back to Thomas Merton's book all the time. This is a book, this could be up there in my all-time favorite books, but I'll go back and reread New Seeds of Contemplation over and over and over again.
Yep, that's a classic. Yes.
Chapter 5. Actually, I have Chapter 5 as a PDF. I actually just send it to people.
You're kidding.
No, I just say read Chapter 5 of New Seeds of Contemplation. I know exactly where it was when I read it.
Yeah.
I was 28 years old. I know the Catholic church I was sitting in when I read it. And that I can point to that moment as being a hinge moment in my life.
Oh, I love that. I feel that way about the last passage of Anne Lamott's Traveling Mercies.
Mm-hmm.
Like I almost know it from memory. And I kept it with me when I was finishing Cold Tangerines. Like if she can finish a book, you know, maybe I can too. I remember exactly where I was when I read it for the first time. I get that. Mm-hmm. Is there a book that you, well, speaking of, is there a book that you give to everyone?
A book that I give to everyone? Yeah. You know, at Christmas time, a book that I always buy 5 copies of is Mr. Ives' Christmas.
Oh.
But Oscar Hielos. Do you know that book?
I do. Yes.
I love that book.
All right. I'm writing that down because I could do a reread of that.
Yeah. It's a book that I just give away at Christmas, you know, and because it's got such a great beauty and it's so beautiful. It's so plaintive, you know, it's just, pulls at the heart and the story is so beautiful.
Okay. So I want to switch over and talk about the world of meals and food and eating. A personal passion area. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's pretend you know somehow that it's going to be your last supper.
Yikes.
I know. You're a 4. You can handle this. You can live in the dark.
Yeah.
The darkness
totally,
of that.
I'm already there. Yeah, totally there. Totally there right now. I'm feeling it. Hold on. I got to light a cigarette. Hold on. Okay, I'm ready.
Where, with whom, and what would you eat?
Oh, okay. Well, that's actually not so hard. It would be in Florence.
Okay.
My wife and I love Florence. There's a little restaurant. I wish I could remember the name of it, but it's in this great kooky neighborhood and it's in a basement, and I would have penne alla vodka, like smoked salmon, like penne alla vodka with smoked salmon. That's what I would have.
Oh, that sounds fabulous.
What's that called?
Fabulous.
It's like penne al salmone. A la vodka.
Yeah.
I
think that's exactly what it is. That sounds like heaven.
And my wife would be there, my kids, my mom, you know, I'd have a, you know, I don't know, probably a polka band or something crazy going on in the background. I have no idea. But if I was a good 4, I would probably just have really sad arias being sung somewhere in the background. But I'd like to think I'd go out with a big party, actually.
All right. I think you are officially the first person who mentioned a polka band to that question. So
yeah, in Italy, which doesn't really make a lot of sense, but
right.
There you go. You know.
Okay. So if I were to come over to your home anytime, what 5 things would always be in your pantry or in your refrigerator?
Well, like when there's actually food in it. Okay. So it's, you know, I love food, but it's so funny because I'm a sparse kind of a eater. I'm kind of a minimalist around food. Oh, boy. Well, you'd always find Earl Grey, loose Earl Grey tea.
Okay.
You'd always find that in my pantry. I drink a lot of tea.
Yes.
Fresh raspberries. Love fresh raspberries. Eat them all. I can eat fresh raspberries and blueberries all day long. You'd always find hummus in my fridge.
Do you make it or do you buy it?
Sometimes we make it.
Okay.
One of my daughters lives in Amman, Jordan, and speaks Arabic, and she loves making Arabic meals. So whenever she's around, we have a lot of hummus, homemade hummus.
Wonderful.
In the house. Lots of that. Okay, so I have an addiction. I have a food addiction. It's apples and almond butter.
Yeah, that's a classic. Yeah.
Every night. It's weird. It used to be cookies, but, you know, I had to give that up. So baked goods. Oh, golly, it's like heroin. But I've now managed my addiction down to almond butter and apples.
That's pretty virtuous. If your worst right? vice involves an apple, yeah. I feel pretty good about that.
Yep. And we always have our standby meal here is grilled salmon, pasta with pesto, pine nuts, and big salad.
That so
we always
perfect.
Have that somewhere. We love pesto. I could put pesto on ice cream. I'd love it.
I love pesto. That's and that's so summery, right? That's like the mm-hmm. perfect summer food.
Oh yeah, especially if you get it like this is like what I want to impress my new friends, you know. In the summer, I get big like red or yellow peppers, and I hollow them out, and then I put angel hair pesto and pasta inside the pepper, with you know maybe grilled chicken or something or whatever else I want in there, and let it just hang over the side like hair.
How beautiful. I love that.
Isn't that nice?
Yes.
Come on. That was such a four guy thing. Okay, I actually described the aesthetic of the entire meal right there.
I love that. So I feel like you kind of skipped ahead. I was about to ask, what's your best recipe or the best thing you make? That sounds pretty great.
Okay, that's pretty good. But actually, I have another though. For that.
Okay.
I make egg muffins.
Really?
Yeah. I know it's so not very from a you know not very sexy from a culinary perspective, but I'm just telling you, I make like the best egg muffins in the world, like with broccoli and cumin and garlic and pepper.
Okay, so you're not talking about like a breakfast sandwich.
No.
You're not talking about an English muffin with eggs in it. You're talking about a muffin made of baked eggs. Is that what we're talking
exactly,
about?
Exactly.
Got it. Now, that's much more elegant than I was thinking you were talking about, which I love. I'm actually a huge breakfast sandwich person, so I would never knock that. But you're talking about kind of a quiche-y little muffin-y thing, yes?
I make them all week and then I freeze them. I eat them every single morning.
Wonderful.
That's a
great habit.
Yeah. We watch a show on Sunday night. I make a whole week worth of egg muffins.
Perfect. Okay, last question. What's one thing you'd love to learn to make?
Fat-free grilled cheese and bacon.
Yes. Yes, when you learn that, you send that recipe to me.
No, because if I do that, I'm going to win the Nobel Prize.
That's true. Yes.
The Nobel Prize for grilled cheese.
That would be a phenomenal award to receive.
Or how about if you could make fat-free mac and cheese with bacon, truffle oil, and lobster tail?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you can figure that out, I will nominate you for all the prizes.
Oh, yeah. Come on. Right there.
Ian, thank you so much. This has been such a fun conversation and...
But now I'm hungry.
I know, right? I'm sorry. I have to go. I have to go make macaroni and cheese and pesto and angel hair and all. And I have to go download a bunch of books. And
Where am I going to go to find fresh lobster in Nashville right now? Pull it out of the water. I'm going to have to fly to Maine.
We go to the Bahamas sometimes with our family. And my son, Henry, who you know, my 10-year-old, just speared his first lobster. By himself.
This
is a big deal. Yeah.
Did Aaron write a poem about Ode to a Lobster?
Aaron was delighted. He was like, it's so funny because we're pacifists. We're not hunters. We're anti-gun. We're like completely not those people unless it's a lobster. And we're like, get it.
Kill the lobster.
We completely.
It's like Lord of the Flies breaks out on the boat. Is that what happens?
All of a sudden. Yeah. We get real excited about the prospect of lobster for dinner. So,
Well, listen, next time you catch us one, have us to dinner and we will come.
Well, we would love that. We always love having you for dinner. So it's great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Shauna Nyquist podcast. If you like what you heard, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes. And for more relevant podcast network shows, check out the podcast section at relevantmagazine.com.